Okay, in this session, we're going to look at the clandestine, the very illegal, various versions of Radio Sinn Féin. And we're not doing it from secondhand sources. We're doing it from, well, from the heart of the matter, from a woman who was centrally involved in running that station, local resident Maureen McGuire. Now, going back to the 1980s, Sinn Féin in particular couldn't get access to radio or television because of Section 31 of the Broadcasting Act. Can you tell us a little bit about what that meant in a day-to-day level? Like, if you're a member of a political movement or a political party, obviously publicity is very important. So what did Sinn Féin do when it found that it couldn't go on RTE, on the radio, that it was a complete no-no? In Britain, at least, they used to have an actor doing the funny accent for Gerry Adams when he'd be interviewed. But in Ireland, you had nothing at all.
Well, I was had been involved in Republican politics in London. And I came back here and decided I'd had enough because I had a lot of trouble with the police. And I bought a house anyway in East Wall. And I joined Sinn Féin. I was already in Sinn Féin in England. So it was just a question of rejoining Sinn Féin here. And at that time, there was quite an active group. There always has been in this area because it has always been a Republican area because of the docks. There was a lot of dockers. And they had the Citizen Army used to do their route marches around here. We were aware of all this. And as I said, we had, I was a member of Sinn Féin. So one day, anyway, a couple of fellas came round and said, we're thinking of setting up a pirate radio because of section, not, you know, about Sinn Féin not being allowed to get on the airways, and we're going to set it up. But we need someone in the area. We're going to set the thing up and break into this thing out in Capule, which was, it was a booster from Belfast to Dublin. It was actually the television mast. So anyway, they landed around with this big long thing. It was about 6 foot long, which rather surprised me, and said they were going up to Capure the mountains because there was a big transmitter up there and try and break in to the radio or the television, whatever else they could, up in the mountains, going to set up this radio. So I said, well, where do I come in? And they said, well, we want someone in the area to have a radio and sit there and wait and see if we break in that we can get you know, something across. So I said, why not? So anyway, I sat there and they came with a huge antenna and then they headed off on a motorbike up into the mountains with the great big 8 foot antenna. So the first day anyway, that was the first time on Sunday they hadn't sorted themselves out. So Monday they were gonna do it and they left my house about 6 o'clock and it was supposed to come on at 8 o'clock. So I, as long as I was there with the radio and then someone would phone me up and see if we got through. So the second day anyway, the Monday evening, away they headed. I sat there all night, and then about 10 o'clock they arrived back and said, did you hear anything? And I said, no. So they said, right, we'll do it. So the following day they did, but they took then, by that time, the mobile phones were coming out, and they managed to get one of these. So the second day anyway, they cleared off, as usual, left their stuff up in the field and sat there at the radio listening to it. Had to keep on one of the, you know, the dials. You couldn't move it. And then to my absolute amazement, I heard Gerry Adams. It actually worked. Couldn't believe it. The fella phoned up and said, have we got through? And I said, yes, you have, and it's Gerry Adams. wherever they got the golden from, Jerry Adams, and couldn't believe it. So they came back and they said, that's great. You know, we've managed to break it. And they were really pleased with themselves. So the following night, anyway, they headed off. Now, it'd been raining all night. They headed off. Now, they were in a field that had sheep in it. And there was an old farmer seeing them. He thought were two tramps, and but ignored it. Just thought, oh, they could be ill. He didn't know what they were. He didn't care. So the third day, anyway, they put the itiner up, fixed it to the fixing. They had some sort of fixing. And lo and behold, they turned it on, and it shot into the sky like a comet and exploded. It broke up. The whole thing broke up. So that was the end of that thing. They didn't go back there, it goes without saying. The only thing is, the farmer said that he saw this, he thought it was a UFO. But in fact, it wasn't. It literally went up into the sky. Now, that's my escapades. Now, the police never got onto us. But I had a friend that was with Desi Ellis's campaign. And he was on the top of the roof. His name, actually, he used to be a poet. You older people might know. He used to be in Grafton Street reading poetry every Saturday. And then used to go around with a hat. Very nice fella. But anyway, He was actually working. They thought they could get it into Ballymun. They went up to the roof in Ballymun. They thought that might act as a booster. So anyway, they were up in Ballymun, and they had that radio going quite well. They had Republican songs on all day long, and it was dead opposite the Ballymun police station. And they had broken in up into the top of it. And when they looked down, they used to see the radio car going by with a thing on the top like this. They knew, the police knew it was somewhere, but hadn't got a clue. They used to see it going past the Ballymun Towers, round again, backwards and forwards, trying to find them, but they never did. Now, that's that thing.
Well, just stop there for a minute. So there were two elements, as well as the normal, if you like, radio station, where as Radio Sinn Féin or Radio Dallas or whatever name was used to be on the air maybe for an hour or two a day. Yeah. But then there was also, you were saying earlier on, the attempts to cut into the RTE news, a tactic which I think originated with the, at the time, the Welsh Language Society trials. I think it was in the late 60s when they'd bring, let's say there's a BBC transmitter, let's just say, at the end of the road. And it would be drawing a signal from their studio and be a very weak signal going to it. So you got in with your transmitter just at the base of it with a slightly stronger signal. That meant you overrode what was feeding into that transmitter, and your signal was sent. So the Welsh language people used to get on like at 9 o'clock, say when the news was on, just burst in for 10 seconds, say, stay tuned after close down for a very important announcement. And people be wondering, what is that? A new TV station? What? And of course, after the close down, they'd give a rundown on the day's trial. So it was that attempt, like, rather than having to go out and build an audience for scratch, see where the audience is and then see if you could draw them to you. Did you ever get much response? Like, obviously there were no addresses for people to write in and no phone numbers for them to call. But did you ever get people outside your own circles mentioning that they had heard these broadcasts?
No, I never did. I don't think they did anyway. I definitely heard it. There was no problem about that. The only thing was, the idea was, if we could have got the thing going, we then could have set ourselves up. Because the chap that was with us, I won't mention his name, one of them's here, but the original bloke that really knew what he was up to, whereas we hadn't a fucking clue, the original bloke doesn't know this is going on. And it was only when someone phoned up last week and said, about this, do you know anything about this? We heard you knew something about it. And I said, yeah, because, this, that and the other. That we agree to. Now, the thing is about it, I had been involved with Pirate Radio because I was involved with Margareta, this one up was Desiela now, but it was Margareta. I used to go down there every year in the summer. She had a really good radio, and the police used to turn a blind eye to it because they'd be in the police cars listening to all this, you know, and it was weird. The only thing was, the only fault I'd say about her, she would not interview any men. She was married to John Arden, the writer. She only would have women on it. Now, she made a lot of recordings at that time. She'd done Rose Dugdale, Rita O'Hare, women in Sinn Féin, you know, and the way they felt about things. But she wouldn't have any men. And that is, you can actually look that stuff up if you're interested. It should be in the, in the Galway University. There's a section with John Arden, their stuff. That's John Arden's Margaretta Darcy's. And it's in there. Them recordings are in there. And the idea was, if we could have got them, she would have played them. But the stuff that she done was mainly local. In fact, if you look at a book, this particular book, I only brought it in, it's all women in it. But you see, I was aware, I had heard Free Derry, and because I moved around a lot that time, and I'd also heard about the in Belfast. And in Longcash, they had small crystal radios, and they were able to listen, but they didn't go for too long. And if you put two batteries together, you could actually use it, bring it up as a radio, but it didn't really last that long. So Bobby Sands, when he was on hunger strike, used to have the pirate radio on, and he'd have it just a cord or something from the transmitter out the window. That'd be enough. It'd only be about a mile radius, but he actually was able to listen to it there because he wasn't allowed a radio. That was really up until he died. Now, the way they done that was the women had to pass, get them, and the batteries, they went out very quickly. They used to put them in, well, it's terrible, their back sides, and carry them in that way, and then just try it and slip them over. So it was all hit and miss. But it was used definitely in Longcash at that particular time. And there was a group of women, only they knew each other, and they were known as the Moor Girls. That, you know, that was the name for the particular unit. So that's what happened up in the north. But Free Derry, you know, you seem to be able to hear everything then. I'm just looking at my notes, not many of them. I'd almost forgotten about it, to be quite honest, until some rang me up. But if we could have got away with it, we would have, you know, in spite of the way it turned out.
Well, the transmitters that were used for Radio Sinn Féin, like, if I'm correct, like the first attempt to have something that was more than a 1 or 2 day station was probably in the was it 1983 or 1984, yeah. Fermanagh, South Tyrone, constituency, the election that year, where I think they were on the air for about 3 weeks. And then in Dublin from about 1987 to about 1991, I think every few months, there was a medium wave transmitter, I think, and an FM transmitter, and they'd be back on like for a while, generally an hour or two a day. Like it would be Radio Section 31, maybe when the legislation was up for renewal in the Dáil. If it was election radio in 1989, it was Radio Free Dublin. I think there was I'm going off to make some programs. There was Radio Desi Ellis when he. So yeah. Like you had at least 4 or 5 years of sporadic but continuous activity, and then it seemed to die. Was it just like once Sinn Féin started getting more elected positions and therefore finding it easier to get access to the media that there was, well, there was no need for this?
Well, they brought in, well, they changed the law. But the funny thing was about it when it happened, I was watching the television the same time as the radio. You know, I had the radio on the table and I had the telly there. And I could have sworn I actually saw Gerry Adams on the television. And I wasn't sure what they were up to up in the mountains or whether or not they'd ever actually got into it. But I remember distinctively thinking I saw him on the television. I definitely heard him on the radio, but I don't know whether or not that could have been possible. I did mention it at the time, but anyway.
Ghosts in the TV.
No, I just wondered whether or not they'd actually got into, by mistake, they'd managed to get into the television. But because of the way it was, I mean, we would have all ended up in the clink. Well, I mean, I did end up in the clink, but not about that. You know, so we didn't really know. And it was a great idea if it had worked.
What sort of range was the station in Dublin getting? How far was the signal being picked up?
Away.
Was it a mile, 2 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles?
Oh, it's much further than that. It was, you know, the transmission air. It's actually up in the mountains, isn't it? So look how far it came. It came right into me there. And if it hadn't blown up, I don't know why it blew up, really. We thought because they... You know, it was such a big antenna. It was 8 foot long. It was huge. And it must have broken it into two and joined it up somehow. And we think, he thought, probably the rain might have got at it because they couldn't drag it back every night. It was too big. So they had to leave it. So whether or not the rain got it or whether or not some of the sheep chewed it, they weren't quite sure. But it was a great idea if it had worked, but it hadn't. But it's surprising, really, that these fellas were only about 17 or 18. That's all they were, and really hadn't got a clue about it all, but knew enough. The other fellow was a genius.
Well, at least your transmitter was in a field. Around the same time, there was a station, Westside Radio, moved into... the Waldorf Hotel on Eden Quay. Well, you probably know us. There's no Waldorf Hotel on Eden Quay anymore because somebody left a dodgy AM transmitter on overnight when there was no one there with nothing cooling it down. So when they arrived back in the following morning, the top floor of the hotel was gone. So like I say, you were lucky you were in a field. But now, after the Radio Sinn Féin, then you got involved with Radio Pirate Woman in Galway. And I suppose to put it into context, the 70s and 80s may have been the high point of radio broadcasting in Ireland, just the sheer number of stations, but you'd be hard-pushed to remember more than about a half dozen women. Women were completely absent from most of the stations, and those that had women on the staff generally relegated them to being newsreaders rather than DJs. In fact, I challenge anybody now, without doing any serious thinking about it, from the 1980s, who can immediately name one woman DJ? Going... One. There we go. It says it all in a way, doesn't it? That's now, yes. And were you on Radio Leinster as well? No. Yeah. But it was great fun, wasn't it?
But I went down to Galway several years. You know, really, years been doing it off and on. And I was amazed that she actually could get any sort of thing because all she done was she just plugged it into the light. That seemed to be enough. But it only went about a mile from where the actual place was. And everyone knew about it. And she was quite open, as you can see by everything up there, the address, so they knew it. So we're in there one, anyway, she said to me, I'll tell you what, Maureen, we need someone, you know, to talk about men's problems because an awful lot of men phone up and there's no one to speak to them because it was a load of old dears. You know, if you look at the pictures there, all these women are about 70. Well, my age now. So anyway, I said, all right then. So anyway, there were two incidents that happened. There was all sorts of weird things happened. But two were, one was a man who used to dress up as, wanted to dress up as a woman, but his wife objected. So anyway, I was quite flippant about it, and I said, perhaps it's because none of the clothes that you were matched, i.e. the hat didn't suit the handbag, or the shoes might have been the wrong colour. I mean, mad stuff. So anyway, that was it. And another night was big rapping on the door, and it was a lesbian that it took a dislike to what I'd said. I don't care. Even in them days, there were lesbian then as well as there is now. I didn't really regard it. She was quite prepared to give me a really good hiding about what I said. I couldn't remember a bloody thing. And all sorts of weird men used to phone up about their sexual problems. And you can imagine stupid bloody answers you were given then. It was a hoot, you know. But you see, nevertheless, Margaret had a serious side to her campaign. The only thing I didn't like about it was the fact there was never any men on it. These weird men would ring up, and you're there trying to give them, well, what sort of advice could you possibly give them? I'm not a man. Simple as that. But everyone was glued to it. And the thing that amazed me, we used to go around dishing out leaflets. Now, the rugby team were down there. The All Blacks were there one day. We met them en masse, freezing, buying jumpers in the sweater shop. We dished out all these leaflets, you know. And I said, Margaret, that's great. Why don't you interview them for the radio? Not at all. They're all men. Won't have a man on mine, which I thought was a bit, you know. But you're probably right. I mean, if you were the only woman that was at it, you know, didn't really get much of a say in it at all. And when you think about the women, particularly in Loncash, and having to go in and sort of do that, you know, would men, I suppose, do it? Possibly. I don't know. But women really didn't, apart from Margaretta's, never heard much about women. Now it's all women, isn't it? And it's all rubbish. You know, there's nothing political at all. Our idea, if we could have got that thing going, we definitely were going to make it a really political stuff. We had it worked out between us. It wasn't a question of men. But it was fair play to the fellas that even thought of doing it. You know, because that time you knew if the police got you, you were in serious trouble. And at that time, my house was always being raided. My old man was in jail anyway. So it was, you know, a bit awkward, but it would have been great if it had come off. But we were successful. I mean, we did get either his ghost. We definitely got him one way and another.
In Galway, Radio Pirate Woman, if I remember rightly, Margaretta started around the late 1980s, and it carried on through...
Still is.
Through the, I think quite regularly up to the mid 90s, and now every now and again.
For 1 month in the summer.
Given that it's been broadcasting for that long, so people in Galway with any interest in media or radio or that will have heard about it. Have you any idea there what sort of response Margaretta was getting to the state, given that its signal wasn't very strong? It only really reached the city centre area?
Yeah, pretty well. Well, I tell you what, everyone knew Margaretta. I mean, in fact, that's why that, you know, the Shelter Sea thing, which she joined that and then ended up in prison. She by that time, every single person has known Margaretta, and they all knew her, and everyone listened to the radio show. You talk to anyone there, they'll tell you. Even the police themselves. There's occasion they'd come and call into the house, you know, and they'd be sitting glued to it. Weirder the programme was, the better, you know. The only complaint I had about the particular show, I don't know where she got them from. The music was absolutely terrible. It'd be like people on bongo drums for about half an hour. And then I heard music I never in my life heard anywhere else on there, wherever the hell it ever came from. It was really weird. And then she'd get it. She had a campaign going about, you know, women's right to work and all the rest of it, and she had a lot of unmarried mothers. And you know, in them days down there, you're talking about 20 years ago, people were very conventional, you know, no one would ever admit to being an unmarried mother. And she was the only one that ever spoke on behalf of, you know, travellers, you know, women travellers. She'd have them on the radio as well, no one else would. She was very, very good, she was exceptional. But there are recordings of all these things, as I said, in Galway. They're in the college down there. But no one, I think it's because she's hard to deal with, really. That, you know, it's never ever mentioned. Like, in this particular book, which is Galway Pirate Women, she mentions absolutely everyone, and all them photographs in it are of her neighbours. They're not really anyone. They're just neighbours and the rest of it. And she doesn't mention me at all, and it was rather surprised. But anyway, but she wouldn't mention anyone that anyone would know. You know, it's a pirate raiding for yourself. It'd be like us setting it up and rambling on, you know. The one actually here that was in Dublin, that wrote that book, the poet, he was great. And he came to it. What happened with him was he was in America, and he became a hippie when he was in America, and he took drugs and he got AIDS. And it was at the time of AIDS when it first sort of started. And he was very uptight about it. But anyway, he had a girlfriend, and she had a little girl that lived with her in the flats in Ballymun. And they were told, the social welfare told his girlfriend, they were going to take the child off her because she was living with Pat and he had AIDS. A terrible thing to do. And he went and hung himself. He hung himself outside a church because he actually had been reared in Galway as an orphan in one of them dreadful homes. He knew all about them, you know, and he was an interesting fella. But it's a pity, really, that there hasn't been more really done about pirate radios then, because they were interesting. I know there was one in Wales you could hear, but in England, in London, I didn't really hear any. I don't know if you did, Siobhan, hear pirate radios in London? Yeah, music. The West Indians had done a lot, but they weren't political, you know, it wasn't really political.
On Radio Pirate Woman, what was the breakdown between music and speech? Was it mostly speech or mostly music?
Yeah, it would be. It depended how many people turned up at the house. Anyone she could get, as long as they were women, she wouldn't allow a man in, you see. For instance, she had a bed there, and John and her used to review books, John Arden particularly, because he was a very well-known writer. And she had a mattress on top of about 1,000 books. That was the bed, was books, new publications, and on it was the mattress. And that was it. She had a crowd of Africans there at one time when I was there. And I had an Aran jumper I knitted, and she gave the African woman the jumper. And I said to her a couple of weeks after that about, you know, I want the jumper back, you know. And she said, oh, you begrudge a poor African woman that's frozen stiff that come over to some conference. She'll have all these weird people there, you know, and you begrudge her the Aran jumper and the rest of it. And I said, well, you know, I thought she was that bad. I'd have given it to her, but I didn't. I just lent her it. And then 3 months later, she came to stay with me. She had the fucking Aran jumper on her, which was a bit annoying, you know. She was terrible like that. And then the food. Now, her sister died. I'll just tell you this last thing. Her sister died, and the radio, I had to go down there for the radio thing, down there, and then she said to me, I'm going to make you a dinner. And I went to Marks and bought all sorts of goodies, and I was broke at that time. Went into Goodies, bought all this stuff, went round there, and she put it in the fridge, and I noticed everything in the fridge was mouldy, you know. And then she went out and she said, I'm making a stew. And she said, I'm going out, she said, from there. And she came in with several large sticks, which she promptly broke and fired it into the pot. This was the bleeding soup. This was the soup. There was nothing in it except sticks. And, you know, she'd be happily feeding this lot out. And I said to her about the food, you know, in the fridge. She said, I bought all the food in the fridge. And she said, no, I'm going to keep that, you know, because, you know, your stuff is much better than that, you know, and that's all off and the rest of it. And John would be sitting there, you know, John Arden, the intellectual thing, and he was odd as well. She'll tell you a story about him.
Go on.
He was in the army. He was a real true Brit. He looked like a Brit, and he was a gentleman, you know. Nice looking fella and all the rest of it. And he used to stay, they used to stay with me here, you know, my house here. And anyway, it came in one day, and what used to annoy me was he used to fold everything up and put it on the bed. He'd take the pillowcase off and everything and fold it and leave it at the bottom of the bed. And away he'd go, and he might be back the same day. This rigmarole, making up the bed and all this carry on. So I said to him, John, why do you do that? And he said, well, I was in the British Army, and I was shown how to do that. So he said, you know, I just do it automatically. So I thought to myself, he's a bit odd, you know. And anyway, they went to India, and they took the family. She had four boys. They took the family to India, and they ended up being arrested on the Pakistani border. So they put the children in with Margareta and put John in a separate jail because the sexes didn't mix there. And after about 4 days, they came and took the children off of Margareta and put them in with the father because they said, she's hopeless, she can't do anything. And it's true, she can't, but she survived. But anyway, she's great, like, politically. That's it. As long as you agreed with her, you could fight with her all day long, you know. So that's Margareta, and that's how you run a pirate radio show for so many years. Just making sure you don't give an inch.
So let me get this right. So some of the shows on Radio Pirate Woman would essentially consist of maybe yourself, Margareta, maybe four or five other women sat around, and did you have any rough idea for a show, or was it just somebody started off a conversation?
Yeah, it was just automatic. Someone would have mentioned something, and then someone, you know, everyone had terrible tales. I mean, she wasn't interested in people that were middle class and had decent lives. She, you know, the worst state you were in, the bleeding better, you know. I was all right because I was a prisoner's wife, you know, and I was obviously up against it, you know. You know, and we'd all in absolute misery. When you came out of the place, you'd have a bloody awful headache.
But it was great crack now, wasn't it?
It was, and she was great. And, you know, when she ended up in prison here, I mean, I went up and get her newspapers. And by that time, I wasn't really feeling great myself. But anyway, went up to get her newspapers. She had the newspapers every day. She was a great campaigner. I mean, she really was a one-off. You'd never really... I can't see this generation ever turning up anyone like her again. You know, and everyone treats her as being slightly mad, but she never was. She just was before her... That's what you could say about her.
That was incredibly diplomatic.
A great feminist.
So would you do it all again?
I would, but I'd like to... The radio would have been great if we ever could have managed to get it going, because that would have been quite interesting. And you really wouldn't mind... Now everyone is so respectable, aren't they? In the old days, people weren't. And there were, you know, if you met characters... I must admit, when I moved from England to here, I found it a bit of a shock how respectable women were here and put up with it. You know, you go to funerals of women and they talk about their husbands as though these blokes are blessed saints. And you know, actually, they're absolute fiends when you talk to the other neighbours about them. I mean, a fella came knocking on my door one day when I came back from England. Couldn't believe it. His wife had died. He was a postman. And he couldn't boil an egg. And he wanted to know how to boil an egg. Which, in England, that never would have happened. But, you know, it happened here. And you're always a blowing, like you saying today, you know, I'm a blowing as well. I'm a blowing in Eastwall, and I've been there 35 years. I'm a blowing as well, you know. So,
any questions, folks?
I
She was exceptional. And, you know, and the pirate radio show, that was exceptional. You would never have heard anything like the conversations that were there. You know, and women would talk to her. You know, even the most sort of women in terrible states. There was a poor woman there when I was there, and she had twins and was homeless. You know, she'd all, now, I mean, there's homeless people on the street now in Galway. She just was exceptional. Mm. And she came from a very respectable background, because I met her sister, not the one that died, this one. Yeah, I met one recently when we had a visit to go and visit her in Mountjoy Prison. And her name was on it and mine. And the sister said, oh, I couldn't go in there, you know, really. She didn't want to. Anyway, I didn't mind. I sort of in there. But I tell you what, when she was in prison, she was in prison in Armagh prison as well. But all she done was, you know, she did write down all their things. And she done the very same when she was in Mountjoy here. You know, all the conversations with women she wrote down, and she then bangs them in books, which is a bit naughty, really, I think. But she does done it.
Oh, she was always a bit naughty, didn't she? In fact, a memory just came to me. It must be nearly half a century ago. Now, not that I'd remember that, but, you know, somebody told me. Herself and John Arden wrote the Nonstop Connolly Show, which was a 24-hour play which ran for 24 hours. I remember people in Liberty Hall with their sleeping bags and their flagons. She was always a different sort of cultural figure.
Well, the 24-hour show, I saw that in London, first of all. And, of course, London had a big hippie community before anyone had it. And the 24-hour show was there. And couldn't believe it, you know, people would do it for 24 hours. But I also took part in the 24-hour show in Essex Street here. She had that recently. She'd done it here. But she managed to get actors, you know, quite good actresses to read it there. But the one in London was really bizarre. The blokes and all in it, there was women with black sacks, sitting in black sacks, part of the thing, and reading James Connolly's. It was bleeding weird, to say the least. At least the one they done in Dublin here was quite good, you know. They had proper, you know, actresses and people spoke very well. It was much better seen here. But in London, the whole show was absolutely bizarre. And yet John's plays at the time, when he wrote that, I went to that in the Royal Court Theatre, Sergeant Musgrave's Dance. I didn't even know who John Arden was. I knew who Margaret was. Didn't know it was her husband. And it was absolutely fantastic. I don't know if anyone else here saw it. Did any of you see it? Well, it was a play about set in the north of England, about the British Army and the Irish Troubles. A wonderful play. And it went all over the world. Now, another thing about it was, you know, she said she had an open marriage, you know. That meant you could do what you liked, you know. And then he got in with an Italian girl and was going to leave her. So she tried to slit her wrists. That's how liberated she bleeding was. When it come down to the nitty gritty, you know, she wanted to slit her wrist if John was going to leave her. So he decided he wouldn't leave her, you know. I felt sorry for John, you know, an absolute gentleman, you know. But anyway, fair play to him. In the end of him, she looked after him very well. It's like Jim Monaghan and Rose, you know, pushing Rose around, you know, now that she's infirm. But that's it. That's the crowd.
Well, that was excellent. And remember, folks, if anybody ever asks you in the future, do you know about any Irish pirate women? Don't be talking about Grace O'Malley. You go, pirate women? Let me tell you about that Maureen McGuire.
I wasn't really part of that scene. I don't, you know. Anyway.
Okay, well, I think that brings us up to...
I'd like to thank you on your speech. I thought it was so interesting seeing all of it, you know, like, well, not just Margaret's stuff, but seeing everyone else, you know, and how they managed, you know.
Right. Well, I think we'll see a lot more in the years to come, as people, some people here probably know, Eddie Bowen is also curator of the Irish Museum of Broadcasting, and it's growing and growing and growing. So, like, I'm sure Eddie will also be happy to receive, if people have any old memorabilia hanging around in their attic, he'll give it a very good home. So I think, Joe, we're back at 2 o'clock. Okay, and thanks again, Maureen.